The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show, Q&A edition. Thanks for joining us again today. I'm going to try to get through a handful. I was about to say a slew of questions. I'm not sure we've ever done a slew, although I don't really know the technical definition of slew. Slew implies, I think, more than four or five. So we're going to get through four or five of your questions today. Jim's rustling up a Social Security question here. I think we're going to start with, as we do traditionally on the show, just kind of evolve naturally this tradition of Social Security off the bat here. But
you may want to not say that.
Oh, we might be trying out something new, starting a new tradition.
Well, here's the problem, folks. No one in this office believes I have gremlins in my tech. But I was downstairs attending a seminar, and I told you my Outlook stopped opening, and the Social Security questions are in the computer. I thought today was an EDU show. Apparently, it's a Q&A show, so most of the Qs are still at home. And we were going to do an EDU, I thought, until Chris told me in the morning, no. I can't open up my Outlook on my downstairs computer, so I thought I would open it up on my iPad, and it's taking forever for the Social Security. I think what it is my iPad hasn't downloaded in like 3 weeks, and it's just taken forever.
So it's getting caught up, yeah.
Yes. And the Social Security question, I keep getting the little... right now, right in front, as we were recording this, it finally opened.
So the tradition is back.
The tradition is back. So I excuse me, folks, for this rambling bit of nothingness. We are going to lead with a Social Security question.
Excellent.
Then we're going to get into a few LTC questions, IRA questions, annuity questions. We got a whole kit and caboodle. But Chris is on a very tight schedule. He doesn't want to go for more than 14 hours today. So... we got to wrap this up in, what, an hour, you said?
Yeah.
All right. So it is a Social Security question on spousal benefits. It is from Washington. Doesn't really say state or D.C. I would assume it's state. Mm-hmm. And always, we're going to protect his anonymity and call him George. Says, Dear Jim and Chris, I love your show and wish you did more of them. Let me repeat that. You didn't hear me, I don't think. I think my mic died a little. So it says, Dear Jim and Chris, I love your show and wish you did...
Oh, I didn't hear you over that.
More of them. Listener, I have been trying for years to get Chris to do two EDU shows a week.
We got other parts of our job to accomplish is the problem.
Well, I just want to say it's, you know... It's what a listener is asking for.
I appreciate the request or comment. Yeah.
On a recent podcast, Chris talked about spousal benefits, but the situation is a little different than mine, so I'm sending this question and hoping that you can clear up my situation. And you being you is not me, I would assume. My wife and I are both 61. Mm-hmm. I'm planning to retire when I turn 62 this October. My wife worked for 4 or 5 years. Oh, excuse me. My wife plans to work for 4 or 5 more years. And remember, they're both 61. Mm-hmm. So he's going to retire at 62. I guess she's going to retire at 66, 67. Mm-hmm. At 62, my Social Security benefit will be $860 a month. And my full retirement age benefit will be $1,329 a month. My wife's benefit at her full retirement age will be $3,200. If I take my Social Security benefit at 62, how will that affect my spousal benefit when my wife begins collecting at her full retirement age? Do I get, well, actually, he doesn't say at her full retirement age. He says at her age 67. That might be past her full retirement age. If she's 61 today, can you do that math quick? I don't know if she's 66 and 10 months or 67.
She's 67. She was born in 1960.
Okay, so she is 67. Okay. Begins taking her benefit when she turns 67. Will I get half of her PIA when she begins taking her benefit? Or will my spousal benefit be reduced because I claim my own benefit at 62?
Your benefit will be reduced whenever you claim early. It permanently reduces your benefit. The only benefit that wouldn't be affected by the claiming of your own early would be an ultimate survivor benefit. So you're not making a decision if you claim at 62 that will necessarily harm you down the road if your wife were to predecease you. But as long as you're alive collecting your own benefit, essentially what happens, let's pretend for a moment that they both claimed at full retirement age at 67, assuming they were born in 1960, which makes sense if they're both 61, might be off by a year depending on the month they were born, etc. But let's assume they both turned 67 full retirement age at the same time. At that time, she'd get $3,200. He would get $1,329, according to his math. But because half of hers, which is $1,600, is bigger than his $1,329, he would get a total of $1,600. But that $1,600 is technically made up of his $1,329 and then an extra $271 of spousal offset. The $1,329 plus the $271 gets you to $1,600. So people always see the $1,600 and just envision it as being half of the, in this case, wife's benefit, the spousal benefit being $1,600. Well, the devil's in the details, and this is where claiming early will affect you. If you claim early your own benefit and only get the $860, he is signing up for, due to his math, and I'm not confirming that this is the right amount, I'm going by his numbers, at age 62, he'd get $469 less than if he claimed at 67. That $469 reduction is permanent. In other words, if he claims the $860 at 62, like he's talking about it, then in when he turns 67 and she does and claims her own, they don't top him up to $1,600. They're going to give him the $271 of spousal offset that he was due at full retirement age. They simply compare the his PIA, the $1,329, and half of her PIA, $1,600, and he is entitled to $271. But if he decides to undermine his core base own retirement benefit by claiming at 62, that's a permanent effect. So moving forward, at 67, he would get a raise. They take the $860 he was collecting at 62, and when he reached, when she turned hers on, and assuming he was full retirement age at that time, which is the scenario we're talking about, they would add the $271. For a total of $1,131. So that, $860 plus $271, $1,131 is what he's going to receive instead of $1,600. So you can see that penalty is effectively permanent. Now, I'm not factoring in cost of living adjustments or those things. As time goes by, these numbers change a little bit due to cost of living adjustments. So we're keeping everything in today's dollars to make it easy to follow. But that is how it would affect you. If you if she claimed immediately at 62, and you know this isn't the scenario, and you were to claim a spousal at that age, you'd not only reduce your own, but you'd reduce the spousal as well. That's not the scenario he's talking about here, so I'm not talking about a reduction of that 271, but that's a potential as well. So there's kind of two things that can affect your ultimate spousal benefit. When you claim your own, if you're entitled to one, and then when you claim the spousal, which doesn't always have to be the same date. In this particular case, he claims his own at 62, isn't entitled to a spousal yet because she has to file first. In his scenario, she's going to do that at 67. He'll also be 67. He will get the spousal offset, but he will never be able to get back to the $1,600 that he could have had he waited for both. Now, I'm not also providing any judgment as to whether it's a good idea for him to claim early or not. I'm simply explaining the rules. May be a great idea, might not be such a great idea. Have to know a lot more about the overall situation. But that's how the basics of the spousal offset work and how the calculation is made.
Okay, sounds good to me.
Good.
And now, anybody else have Social Security questions again? Send them in. Chris likes to lead with a Social Security question. We do have a few more, but again, it's a pain trying to get them out of my iPad today for some reason, but this one did open, so we answered it. We'll get to the other ones next week. But of course, listeners, send any and all questions to us, and we'll try to answer them as soon as we can. So we have a different kind of question. I think we covered this on past podcasts, but it's been a little while, so I thought I would chat about this one again. Mm-hmm. It comes from a listener in California. She gives her real name, but she also jokingly, but everyone seems to know how Chris and I do it. She put in parentheses Georgette next to her real name from California. Hi, Jim and Chris. I have a question on IRAs versus 401k protection from fraud. I listen to a lot of retirement podcasts depending on the topic. I must say, yours is the best overall from a Social Security, IRA, and retirement question in general perspective. And she wrote best, just so you know, Chris, all in caps.
Wow.
Yeah. So she shouted it out. But thank you, listener, for the kudos. We appreciate it. She then takes a little bit of time, folks, which I'm not going to completely read through. She takes about five paragraphs to describe and tell us and explain to us, Chris, that she has a 401k with the state of California. She is contemplating retirement, and she could move her 401k to an IRA at Schwab. And she's wondering about doing that. Mm-hmm. And she says, I'm confused about the protections offered. Offered by a traditional IRA versus a 401k. Mm-hmm. I thought that the 401k has more protection, which is one reason I may retain the 401k rather than rolling it to a traditional IRA. She explains, I was listening to a podcast and the host mentioned 401k fraud. Keep that in mind, Chris. Mm-hmm. Wherein the account was hacked and the owner's funds transferred into an unknown account. The host of the podcast went on to say that was because ERISA, which protects 401ks, was created pre-internet.
Oh my gosh.
And whoever is responsible for that cyber fraud is not very well defined. So which will give me more protection against fraud? A traditional IRA or a 401k? Thanks for all you do. And I love, oh gosh, she's giving you a little shout out here. Mm. And I love Chris's soft-spoken and mellow voice.
Isn't that sweet? I think I've blushed for the second show in a row.
Do you pick up on what I pick up, Chris?
Yes. This actually, now we didn't hear the other podcast. We're just going by what she said.
I will say, if I could interrupt you before, she does say, I think the podcaster mentioned it was an article from the Wall Street Journal. I read the journal. I never picked up on that. Mm-hmm. But irrespective, she made it clear, fraud, fraud, fraud. Mm-hmm. And I was shocked that she said this podcast host
blamed it on ERISA.
Exactly. Why don't you explain that what ERISA protects from is bankruptcy and general creditors, not fraud?
Right. The ERISA is set up to help protect the participants in the plans, because prior to ERISA, there was not as robust a system of protections for the participants. It kind of allowed the plan creators or owners, the companies, the sponsors, I guess would be the right way to say it, to handle them differently and not as specifically in protection of the workers that were, or employees that were part of the plan itself that the plan was supposed to benefit. So it provides a whole lot of rules and regulations, mainly to protect the participants. It isn't to protect the companies, it's to protect the participants themselves. And as part of that, there's bankruptcy and creditor protection built into the ERISA law for ERISA plans, 401ks being an example of such a plan. What she's describing is more of a cybersecurity issue, which has nothing to do with ERISA or a law. It has totally to do with the platform upon which the plan and the funds, the custodian, is holding them. And I don't know that there's going to be clear evidence as to one being, quote, safer than another. But I will tell you, these companies are hyper vigilant in protecting this. And one downside is it causes you to jump through a lot of hoops when you want to move some of this money. But that's intentional, so that someone can't just log on and transfer money out from under you. So I would say if you're looking for this, if you're mostly worried about this, I would read the custodian's or the plan administrator's document on cybersecurity and see which one you're most comfortable with. But I would bet you'll find that most of them are pretty darn similar, and that there's not a gross difference. Because if there was one that was clearly unsafe, no one would ever use it as far as an IRA custodian goes. You're not going to have a choice on your 401k. That's whichever one your company has chosen to administer your plan. But those are all, not all, but generally large companies with full-blown security departments, and they have processes in place to help protect against what you're describing. I don't remember the last time I heard a legitimate story of this happening. I hear rumors, and I'm sure it must have happened. I can't imagine that in 2021, there's no instance of this happening, but I think it's harder than you might imagine for this to happen.
Yeah, and I will just go on to add, just to help this listener understand and all listeners in general, there is nothing right now in existence or even being proposed where the federal government is going to protect your retirement accounts from essentially user fraud. You were victimized by fraud somehow, and there's many different ways that electronic fraud can happen, and that the government is going to protect it. They do have laws that custodians, pretty much anyone in the financial services industry, not just custodians, have to have very strict cybersecurity systems in place. But there's nothing that is putting the onus on ERISA to say, hey, we're going to protect. If your money is stolen by fraud, we, ERISA, the government's going to step in and make you whole, or we're going to hold the firm responsible and make you whole. I don't think any custodian would want to hold assets, Chris, if the government passed a law and said, if someone's the victim of fraud, could even be click fraud, you mistakenly click something and your password is being stolen and you don't know it, and hold a firm responsible for making you whole for user fraud, I don't think anyone would hold assets anymore. It's just too much liability on their shoulders. Keep in mind what ERISA is designed to protect you from, folks. First, it is designed to protect you from the company itself. Mm-hmm. Prior to ERISA, companies were raiding retirement plans. So ERISA was designed to protect you from the company's nefarious actions itself and to protect spouses in the case of divorce. You are having spouses, especially stay-at-home spouse and a working spouse, and then comes retirement and the working spouse divorces or runs away and has all the money and nothing for the spouse. So they pass very strict rules to protect married spouses. And we've talked to them about them on the past shows, and I'm sure we'll talk about them on future shows. And then they passed rules in ERISA to protect those accounts from bankruptcy and general creditors. Don't confuse the two. There is a bankruptcy creditor and then general creditors. And ERISA protection, which is granted most employer plans, including 401ks, but not government plans. The government has exempted themselves from ERISA rules. Wonderful how the government passes rules, then exempts themselves from it. But you do have to keep in mind, folks, some of you with government plans do not have ERISA-protected plans. But that said, she asked about a 401k. So 401ks are protected under ERISA for bankruptcy and general creditors. A general creditor is the car full of attorneys that you T-boned at an intersection because you weren't paying attention, you went through a stop sign, and now they're all suing you. That's a general creditor. Bankruptcy, you run out of money, and people are coming after you for money. Two different things. But ERISA plans, 401ks, get 100% creditor protection and 100% bankruptcy protection. IRAs get partial bankruptcy protection. Right now, it's about 1,360,000 thereabouts. They adjust it every year. So an IRA has that much in protection, but that is contributions. No one's ever contributed $1,362,000 of contributions. So it's your contributions and growth of the IRA that are protected up to $1,362,000. However, if you move a 401k into an IRA, the full unlimited ERISA protection, you could have a $4 million 401k and a $4 million IRA. And the IRA is comprised of just contributions and growth. The IRA is only going to be protected, Chris, up to $1.3 million, whereas the 401k is fully protected, in my example. But if you move that 401k into an IRA, folks, all that ERISA protection on that $4 million also transfers over. So ERISA protection on bankruptcy in an IRA will transfer. But an IRA that has contributions is only protected up to $1.3 million now. It's like $1,360,000. And that number gets adjusted every year. So sometimes the Ed Slot folks say, if you are truly worried about being sued and you want bankruptcy protection, move your 401k into a standalone IRA, even though it's not required. Just do it and put no other money in it, Chris. So you can easily say, hey, that $4 million IRA right there, that is all 401k money, and I can prove it. And I have never added to it, and I can prove that, so it's fully protected. Mm-hmm. And my IRA over here, that was all my contributions, and that's protected up to $1.3 million. You could mix them, but then it's hard to prove, Chris, what dollars are protected and what dollars aren't. You follow me?
Yes.
So that's bankruptcy. Creditor protection is given, listener, by the states. So creditor protection is, again, that T-bone accident of attorneys at an intersection and now they're all suing you. That's a general creditor. It may lead to bankruptcy, but that's a general creditor who's going after your wealth. That protection on an IRA is given at the state level. And the state of California, where you are from, gives minimal.
Yeah, it's not great.
No, protection to IRAs from general creditors. Mm-hmm. So everyone listening, if you are truly worried about being sued, and asset protection is hugely important to you, you need to know the asset protection rules of your state. Colorado gives very good mm-hmm. asset protection. California does not.
Right.
So I just wanted to clear the air a little on that.
One thing I'll add, while Jim was talking, I reviewed a few of the major custodians' websites about this issue, and I'm not going to name names because I didn't do a full and comprehensive review, but they all have, it appears, their own cybersecurity insurance. And as long as if funds are removed from your account without your permission in some kind of a, you know, hack as your or fraud that you're talking about, you have some basic responsibilities, like you must have taken reasonable steps to protect your own account, using a good password, you know, not sharing it with people, that sort of thing. You have to file a police report. You have to report it as soon as you discover it. So you have some basic responsibilities. As long as you do all those things, the money will be protected through this insurance. So again, you'd want to check with your specific custodian on this. There are, I'm sure, limitations that will vary from custodian to custodian, but they all recognize this is an issue and have taken out, deployed a lot of their own procedures and protocols to protect things. But identity theft is rampant, right? And that's something that it isn't really a failing of the system. It's somehow someone pretended to be you successfully. As long as you've, you know, taken reasonable care to protect yourself and you follow the basic, you know, common sense rules, you're going to have a certain level of protection with these major custodians. You'd have to check yours for the specific.
I would say that kind of reminds me when you read that. Mm-hmm. And again, this, folks, is just my personal opinion. But, we were talking today, Chris, when I got another fraud phone call on my phone, and you jokingly said it's probably about your warranty on your vehicle running out. And
right.
It was.
Right.
You were right. It was. And on those vehicle warranties, and I'm not saying the fraudulently sold one, but even the reasonably sold one, good luck trying to actually claim and get what you think. With this, I don't know how much of what you just read is marketing gizmo mm-hmm. and how easy it would actually be. Because think about it. If they have to protect themselves from this risk that is going through my mind. If you are really good with computers, what if you are actually a hacker and a fraudster and you can make it look like your account was hacked and your $1 million all of a sudden is gone? But it went into something that you set up because you're so good at hacking. It looks like it was professionally hacked. It looks like the money is in Nigeria somewhere. Looks like you're an innocent person. And all of a sudden, they're going to replace $1 million like it was nothing. Oh, sorry that this happened. You filed a police report. Here you go. Here's your million. Good luck trying to actually claim on that and how much of that is just marketing gizmo. I just wanted to throw that out there.
Well, I think that's been that's more pessimistic than I would view things. I'm certainly not going to claim that this is no one ever needs to worry about anything. This is going to cover it. But they've got a reputation to protect, and this is going to be embarrassing enough that this happened. And then if they don't come through on their promise, I think that's going to be pretty bad. And they're not taking the risk. They've bought insurance for this.
No, it's the insurance company that'll fight it, not the custodian. Yeah. The custodian has no say. They're going to say, hey, we got insurance. Go file your claim. I'm saying the insurance company. What hoops are you going to have to jump through? What type of fraud investigation is the insurance company going to do to prove you were really hacked? So that's all I want to say. So it's one thing to say, yeah, I've got this protection. It's another thing to actually file the claim and get it.
Yeah, I think the first level of defense against this is use your own common sense.
Yeah.
Be careful up front. It's a lot better to prevent this than to try to clean up the mess afterwards. So especially with your financial accounts, you need to use really strong security. I recommend multi-factor security. So not just a simple password anymore, a password with, in addition to that, some kind of notification on your mobile device or email or something where both have to happen to grant you access. That increases the difficulty level tremendously for a hacker to try to access your account and do anything. So that's the simplest thing I think just about anybody can do to really improve the level of security. And then as new security protocols come out, embrace them. Mm-hmm. They're going to come up with new stuff all the time to prevent this. And the days of a simple password, in my opinion, for anything secure is over.
It's over. Yep.
It's over. That's why all your financial institutions are going to this multi-factor. And if it's not mandated now, I think it will be for their own protection. I mean, they've got to watch out for you or they're not being a fiduciary. So anyway.
Okay.
We've probably covered this.
Well, we want to get on before we run out of time. Chris has a hard close and he insists on only doing one EDU show a week,
Well, this is a Q&A show, so.
Whatever this is. One Q&A show a week, even
and
though.
And one EDU.
And we have people asking for more. And again, folks, if you, too, would like to have more of the EDU show every week, send your email to chris@jimhelps.com.
That's a form of doxing, just so you know.
What is that?
It's when you divulge someone's personal information so they'll attack them.
No, you give out your email all the time, but
not for attack purposes.
Anyways, folks, if you would like to have two Q&A shows a week, email chris@jimhelps.com.
I'd be happy to do two 30-minute Q&A shows.
Yeah, okay, gee, thanks. All right, Miss Connecticut, the poor woman has been waiting for weeks to have her question answered, but mm-hmm. somehow we never do. So she gives her real name, mm-hmm. but we are always going to call her George or Georgette in this particular case. Hi, Jim and Chris. I just listened to your podcast number 2105. In case you forget, Chris, that was back in January. So,
okay.
It was a podcast on traditional long-term care policies versus hybrid long-term care policies. That was back when we were doing a lot of shows on LTC. It was right after my stroke, as you remember. And I was sharing with people a lot of information on that. Okay. Do traditional long-term care policy issuers insert themselves between the long-term care service provider and the policy holder, like medical insurers often do, in an effort to get discount on care? Do I have to belong to a preferred provider network? If I receive funds under a hybrid LTC policy and pay my LT service provider directly, might I pay the list price rather than what an LTC insurance company's discounted rate may be? What she's talking about there, mm-hmm. folks, is a indemnity policy, a cash indemnity policy.
Well, even if it's a reimbursement.
Well, reimbursement policy. Would pay directly. I'm going to answer her question in a minute because it doesn't work like health insurance, so that's the good news. Yeah. But when she said that she get in a reimbursement, it goes directly to the provider. It generally doesn't go to you. On LTC policies, because most of the people aren't capable of handling their finances or doing that, and it reimburses directly to the provider. But I concede it could, in a reimbursement policy, I guess, technically go to you and then
yeah, if you paid it and then submitted a receipt in order to get reimbursed, it could be coming back
to
you.
And then it could work that way.
In that case, I know what she's saying. You might pay full retail because you don't have the, quote, contract rate like you would with medical insurance. Would it have been better for them to deal directly and, you know, not eat up as much as your long-term care benefit? But good news is it doesn't work that way, right?
Right. And if you had a cash indemnity, which was the other option that I was saying in addition to Chris's thoughts behind it. Cash indemnity policy, folks, in case you don't know, pays you cash.
Right.
Just pays you cash. You do whatever you want with it. You can use it to pay for long-term care, or you can use it to go buy Oreo double stuff. I mean, it doesn't matter. You can do whatever you want with the money. She's wondering if LTC insurance works similar to health insurance, where you don't know what the hell's the price, what's being paid, there's the price that you pay, there's the price the insurer pays, there's a copay, there's a deductible. The insurer sometimes insists on only paying something that they agree to, and you're being stuck with having to pay the rest. None of this applies in LTC insurance because it's not health insurance. It's long-term care insurance, and it's set to pay a stated amount every day or every month. Depends if you have a daily benefit or a monthly benefit. And they will just pay the costs of the care. In the case of a reimbursement, they will pay to reimburse you for the cost of care you incurred up to your policy limits.
And that's how they limit it. Instead of dealing with this contract for fees for service like we do with health insurance, they limit it by putting the daily or monthly cap on there. That's effectively how they're accomplishing the same thing. So that's where they limit it. You do have to prove expenses on a reimbursement style up to that, but it's going to be pretty easy to hit your limit. So you're almost always going to submit or be able to submit expenses above the limit, so you'll get your full benefit for the daily or monthly that's quoted in your policy is what I've seen mostly. Because few people have such a huge benefit that they have trouble meeting it once they need care, but I guess it's possible.
Right. So it doesn't work like health insurance is the good news. You will get your stated benefit amount as long as you have incurred expenses up to that amount, unless you have a cash indemnity policy, which will just pay you the cash. If you have a cash indemnity policy that pays $5,000 a month, every month you get $5,000, whether you spent $100 on your care or $10,000 on your care, you're still getting $5,000.
Right. Indemnity is like a light switch. It just is either on or off. Qualify and it's turned on and it comes out, or off. A reimbursement policy is more like the spigot on your house where it turns on, but there's a maximum that'll flow out, right? That's the limitation on your benefit. But you have to submit in order to get it fully open. You have to have expenses that get you to that limit. Again, most people find it pretty easy to hit the limit, so they get the amount, but technically it's a variable valve instead of an on switch.
Okay. We have another LTC, more of a comment. Well, comment slash question. When we mentioned not too long ago, this question came in a couple of weeks ago. We did a question on the Q&A show, if you remember, Chris, and we talked about the unicorn of LTC policies, if we could get it, but we can't, is what?
Something with a long, long elimination period, kind of like catastrophic LTC, I guess you could think of it, where you are on the hook for a large amount up front, but it's limited. Once you hit that limit that you signed up for, then they kick in and pay. And the concept is this would be far less expensive, and should be, because just like catastrophic health insurance is far less expensive in premiums than traditional insurance that starts paying you nearly immediately. Same thing we're looking for with LTC doesn't exist yet.
Right. In other words, the out-of-pocket expense generally of LTC policies today, now there's some variation in this, but generally speaking, 90-day elimination period is what they call it. And every policy has a different way of defining those days. Some are calendar days, so they literally measure 90 days from when a doctor says you cannot complete 2 of 6 activities of daily living, or you are cognitively impaired, and it takes 2 doctors on the cognitively impaired. But they'll count 90 days from that point, Chris, and then start covering you. The other one is service days. Those policies tend to be a little cheaper because you might only need care, Chris, 2 days a week. So your 90 days is going to take a lot longer than 90 calendar days. You see how that works?
Mm-hmm.
So that's the traditional way of your deductible, if you will. What is going to be your out-of-pocket expenses?
I've seen more 6-month elimination periods lately on people.
Get 6. I've seen a 180, but when we priced out 180s relative to 90 days, it really wasn't that much of a difference.
Yeah.
But what Chris and I are talking about, and many in our industry are clamoring for, since most people need LTC for less than 3 years, many, many people, not most, but a lot of people, could afford to self-fund, Chris, 3 years of care, if need be, but trying to fund 5 years, 7 years, 8 years, 10 years, if you're one of the unlucky people who suffer a stroke, unlike mine, but a stroke where you don't come out from it like I did, or Parkinson's, or dementia, or Alzheimer's, those horrendous diseases that cause you to linger but don't generally make you pass away right away, and you can live a very long time. So in theory, if you got a policy with a 3-year elimination period, so you cover the first 3 years. Now you know your out-of-pocket expense, Chris. You know your risk. Mm-hmm. And then the insurance company covers with a massive amount, not just $500 a month after that. Right. Just it covers everything. It's got this massive deductible up front of 3 years, and then it's covering, now within limits, but it's covering mm-hmm. enough in a month that it's going to cover any conceivable expense you could have, and that lasts for your life or for 5, 8, 9 years, and you combine that and it mm-hmm. pretty much covers everything. It's that type of policy we're clamoring for. Okay, he had an idea. He had an idea. Mm-hmm. And he was wondering, would this kind of do the same thing? So he said, where did I leave off on here? Regarding the question of South Carolina, listen, regarding the availability of catastrophic LTC coverage, would utilizing a permanent life insurance policy with a long-term care rider help in this situation? I've read about such policies but have no practical experience with them. But what he's thinking of is this. Could one cover their long-term care costs out of pocket until their set-aside funds are exhausted? Let's use 3 years in the listener's example, and that's what we're mm-hmm. using here. And 3 years, listeners, again, isn't randomly discovered. In our industry, stats have shown people need it generally for 3 years or less, and that's where that 3 years has come up. Once the 3 years is exhausted, they then turn on the flow of funds from the life insurance policy's long-term care rider. Is there something in insurance policies that require the holder of a long-term care policy to immediately file for benefits? Or could they just wait, use their 3-year reserve pool, and then turn on the long-term care rider on their life insurance policy? So let me say a few things first. I want to talk, Chris, not mm-hmm. about using life insurance rider. Let's just talk about his strategy as if he said, mm-hmm. couldn't you have a long-term care policy but mm-hmm. don't activate it for 3 years? Okay. Yep. Mm-hmm. That's essentially what he's asking for. Mm-hmm. I am going to, when I got this email, I got a hold of Greg. Mm-hmm. And I said, hey, Greg, we're going to bring you on the show because, folks, yours truly does not like at all trying to use riders on long-term care, excuse me, riders on life insurance policy as a means of protecting for long-term care. There's so many gotchas with them. So we're going to get Greg on the show. I don't know when. He's going to come on. He's going to talk to us a little bit about that. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you have to understand the difference between a critical care rider and a chronic care rider, and especially the riders, folks, that require no separate underwriting. The riders that do require underwriting, Chris, they, I will concede, will operate more like a long-term care policy because you actually have to go through underwriting mm-hmm. to get that rider. But most of the riders are the quote-unquote free ones that mm-hmm. a lot of life insurance agents use to kind of spice up the sale of a permanent policy. Oh, and it has a long-term care rider, and it's free, it's included, and you don't have to do any type of underwriting. And you're going to be able to get at your death benefit early if you need it for long-term care. It sounds wonderful until you start peeling back those onions. So I'm going to leave that mm-hmm. at that. Let's talk about his concept instead, Chris, mm-hmm. because I know where his theory is failing, and I think you're going to pick up on it as well. Couldn't you just have a long-term care policy sitting there in the sidelines and use your own pool of money first, and then when that's gone, turn on the long-term care policy and accomplish the same thing you and I are talking about?
Well, the last part's not going to work, but up until that point, yes, you could do that. And the insurance company would love for you to fail the ability to do 2 of 6 activities of daily living and not claim a benefit. You would be the perfect policy holder for them. Use your own money for 3 years, and then if you still need it, you call them up and you start your benefit. They would love for you to do that. why this doesn't work? It's because you're shooting yourself in your own foot, because the premiums you're paying are assuming you're going to turn it on early. You're paying for a benefit and then walking away from it, essentially. So the finances don't work on this. You're paying for a 90-day or 180-day elimination period. You're walking away from it for 3 years. They're going to win more often than not because you're not going to live long enough to collect enough benefit on it, but they charged you premiums as if you were claiming it. So it doesn't work. The math doesn't work is the problem. It's not that you're not allowed to do it. It's just that it doesn't accomplish our goal, which is to make the premiums far more affordable, because the insurance company is taking less risk by having a 3-year elimination period, so they price the policies appropriately. That's not happening in your scenario.
Exactly, and that's where I was going to go with it. And the same with your thoughts on the life insurance, listener. In addition to all the other caveats I have, and we're not going to get into it on this show, the policies, benefits built into the life insurance contract are still priced, because there is a, right. Even the ones that you allegedly don't pay for and go through underwriting, there's still a cost. And it's being factored into the amount of death benefit you can actually get out and use for LTC. And they're factoring that in as if you're going to file right away. Yeah. So as Chris said, you would be a dream come true for the insurance company. You're going to buy something priced to be used immediately, essentially, but not use it for 3 years?
Right.
Well, you're a dream come true for them. And it just won't work. The whole reason people like myself and Chris and other competent advisors who understand a lot of this concept love the idea of a 3-year deductible is it truly would be catastrophic coverage. The sellers of those policies will know. The vast majority of those people, Chris, will never use it.
Right.
And those that do need it can easily be supported with the 70, 80, 90% of premium payers who never use it. Those premiums would be so low relative to what we're paying today, outrageously low. Right. That's what makes the strategy work.
That's why homeowners insurance is so inexpensive relatively. For a fairly low amount, you can insure a very expensive home. Why? Because the vast majority of people's homes don't burn down. It's just the math behind it. They can collect a little bit from a ton of people, and then the handful that actually have these massive claims, and that's what we're talking about here, the small percentage of people that have a very long-term care event, they can be paid. Everyone paid a little bit in. Instead of the way it's priced now, where a lot more people are going to go on benefit, so they have to price it appropriately. That's what we're getting at.
Minus those of you in Florida who have to pay for that outrageous hurricane protection. Your home is expensive.
It's a little bit more, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, next question. We have one on annuities.
Perfect.
How much time do we have left?
One question more.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wait a minute. Do I want to get to that one? Yeah, we'll get to this one. It's a shorter question. Okay. This question comes, well, I have the name. We're going to call him George, not the state, but that's okay. Dear Jim and Chris, I just listened to your last show, and this came in a couple of weeks ago, so it wasn't literally our last show, and had a question regarding when to purchase a deferred income annuity if you should need one. You suggested, based on retirement projections and the potential for a full gap in income, for those individuals to set aside the money and not purchase a deferred income annuity. Do you want to kind of explain that a little for those who didn't hear that show, Chris?
Yeah, the quick summary on that is when in projections you're looking forward and you anticipate the need, don't make the mistake of relying too heavily on your ability to tell the future. Things change. The chance that you put in a retirement plan that you've done yourself, or you paid a hefty fee for one done by a professional, that they have nailed what your situation's actually going to be 15 years from now, that's dreaming. So we prefer, instead of you locking in a decision today for something that may occur, and maybe if it's likely to occur 15 years from now, instead of handing over your resources to an insurance company, locking them up, basically hoping that the situation evolves the way you predict, hang on to your own money. Hang on to your money. Now, the commitment you need to make is setting it aside. It isn't a give it to the insurance company or let's go blow it on vacation. Those aren't the choices. It's give it to an insurance company for a deferral period or hang on to it and see if you need to employ the interaction with the insurance company when the time comes. The only times I kind of deviate a little bit from that is there's people that are worried about getting old and not wanting to put the burden of the decision, and it's pretty clear they're going to need it. And if it isn't, if the projections don't end up real close to what we thought, there's still a benefit to having the annuity income. Sometimes then you can make a, you know, make some sense of a deferred, kind of a set it and forget it. I call it the Ron Popeil approach. Those few of you will get that joke. Set it and forget it kind of approach with a deferred type of annuity. But for the most part, we prefer hanging on to your own money, keeping it set aside, knowing it's there for the ultimate, you know, decision to be made later when you now have seen how your situation has evolved. If it makes sense, then the money's right there, you do it. If it doesn't make sense because situations changed, you'll be thankful that you didn't hand that money over 10, 15 years ago to an insurance company, and now you're trying to figure out how to squeeze as much out of that as possible before you pass away or can't use it anymore. That's why we prefer hanging on to it. Probably a longer answer than you wanted, Jim, but I was on a roll.
That is true, and I'm glad you went into that depth so listeners understand where we're coming from, because, folks, I was just on an annuity class today right before we recorded. I signed up for a 5-part class on annuities. Don't want to bore you all with it, but everyone here knows I do a lot to continue my education. And this topic was addressed in that class, Chris. Mm-hmm. And I disagree. And I'm not going to name, I told you who the three presenters were. I'm not going to name which presenter was talking, because I disagree. I agree with what he's saying academically. I disagree with what he's saying practically. And I don't feel the full story is being presented, nor do I feel the money article that he references from Money Magazine. Because he goes on to say, and the presenter today was saying the same thing, Chris, when it comes to a deferred income annuity, the sooner you buy it, the more money you're going to get. So he references, he being the listener, says, according to this article from Money Magazine, the earlier I buy a deferred income annuity, the more benefit I will receive. In fact, see the quote directly from that Money Magazine below. And he quotes, and this is a direct quote, he put it in quotation marks. As to when to purchase the annuity, annuity being deferred income annuity, the younger you are, the better the deal. If you make a $50,000 purchase at age 55 instead of age 65, and benefits kick in at age 85, you will get 50% more income a month. Now, pause before we dig into this. They're not saying the whole story here.
Right.
It's the same thing today, though, Chris, on the presentation. One of those three presenters, and we're not going to name them, folks, because they're very well-known people. One of them was saying the same thing, that you will get more mortality credits dollar for dollar the sooner you buy the annuity. What are both the presenter today and Money Magazine missing out on? The growth that Chris and I are saying should happen with the money. The Money Magazine says you put $50,000 in at 55 or $50,000 in at 65, you're going to get more.
That's a terrible comparison.
Exactly. Well, what if you took that $50,000 at 55 and invested it?
For 10 years.
And what if it grew and doubled or tripled or dropped? I admit it could. And you put that full amount of money in, Chris.
At 65.
Better yet, they're talking about buying an annuity at 85, turning it on. So Money Magazine is saying, for 30 years, you are going to lock up because you know, beyond a shadow of a damn doubt, what in the heck is going to happen to you for the next 30 years. Yeah. So you're going to buy this annuity now, so in 30 years, you turn it on. Mm-hmm. What if you put that $50,000, folks, in a very well-managed, moderately aggressive, conservatively aggressive, well-diversified, annual rebalanced, passively managed, low-cost indexing strategy? See where I'm going with this, Chris? Mm-hmm. Who knows what in the hell that $50,000 would grow to at 85? Now you should compare, what does your DIA today with locked-in low interest rates, because those interest rates stay locked in on every purchase, how much is that going to give in income relative to what you might be able to buy with who knows what that $50,000 grew to in 30 years? Right.
And they're ignoring the what if your life changes during that 30 and years and you don't need it at all.
Yes, exactly. So I think today's presenter and Money Magazine, academically speaking, what they're saying is true. Practicality speaking, it's not an apples-to-apples comparison.
Right.
And it lacks what I call planning reality. There is the academic approach, and Chris is an academic. I'm not throwing him under the bus. But academics generally, except for Chris, aren't planners and aren't really looking at reality. And the reality is, in 30 years, things are going to happen to you that you can't even fathom. That's why Chris and I, and again, we're not pro-annuity, we're not anti-annuity. We find them a tool. I actually like them if used appropriately. I just feel the responsibility for the 55-year-old in this example, their responsibility, Chris, was to reserve the money. Mm-hmm. And if that is $50,000, put it aside. And let the 85-year-old you decide. Do I need a lifetime income stream at 85? Do I have a short life expectancy? Am I even alive at 85?
Even if you put it off and give the 75-year-old or the 70-year-old the decision-making, you know, admitting that at 85, maybe your financial, mental capabilities aren't where they should be for making this decision, certainly you've got some time at 55. You've got a long time before you should be pulling the trigger on something. Hand money over to a financial institution, insurance company at this, you know, in this particular story. Let's see how things go.
I agree.
And see how things go. The older you will be happy that the younger you did their part, which is to set aside some money for them to be able to generate this income when they need it,
and,
if they need it.
And you asked, what do I think of Money Magazine's article? You know why I don't read Money Magazine, folks. Articles like that. Yeah. It wasn't given the full comparison. Mm-hmm. They should have said, well, if that $50,000 you put away at 55 grew to this at 65, that would then go into, because they're talking about buying a DIA at 65 and still postponing it to 85.
Yeah.
Well, the amount of money going into the DIA at 65 would be significantly greater, hopefully, if that account grew than it was at 55.
They're assuming you leave the 50 grand in a box under your bed.
And do nothing with it. Exactly.
Is that a rational assumption to be making?
No.
I don't think so.
No. No.
And
not
that's
at all.
You got to read between them. They have some good stuff in there. It's mostly entertainment and they're easy to read, but they're not going to necessarily pick up on what we're talking about.
Right. Some of these nuances. Yeah. So Chris and I stand passionate. Well, I do passionate. He's Mr. What did you say? What did that woman say? You're calm and...
I'm kind of calm.
I'm calm and sit today. I don't know. Yeah. She was just brown-nosing you. But she was being nice to you. I'm trying to find where it is.
That seems to be a theme the last
couple
months.
Is, and I'm getting fed up with it. I nearly die, and you're getting all the accolades. What did you say the other day? My statute of limitations on my what has run out?
My pity. On the pity party is over.
Here it is. I love Chris's soft-spoken and mellow voice. I get passionate on this, folks. That is Chris's passionate voice, by the way, that you're listening to. That's when he gets fired up in the office.
That's
God, stand back, because you can hear him across the room. But anyways, folks, Chris and I are passionate on this. We truly feel the responsibility in retirement is the younger you to guarantee explicitly that the older you will have their minimum dignity floor protected. But the decision to buy an annuity should be the older you's decision. The only exception to that, QLACs, when used in an IRA, specially to reduce required minimum distributions. We've used DIAs, which QLAC is a DIA, in a few examples like that for some people. But outside of that, we are passionate. We would rather you keep your money liquid, not in an annuity, and just make sure the dollar amounts are there, because especially in this money magazine example of 30 years before you need it, that's much too long to lock that money away in a DIA. You don't know what is going to happen. And in a DIA, depending on which one you chose, if you pass away, the only thing you get is a return of your premium. There's no embedded growth on it. What if you passed away, Chris, in year 29? Oh, you get your $50,000 back 29 years later. Not you, but your beneficiaries. Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. Gee, thanks.
Right.
What if you had that $50,000 in an investment account and you never touched it because it's off limits, and you passed away in 20 years? What's going to pay you more or your beneficiaries more? Let the older you make the decision to buy the annuity. The younger you needs to make sure the money is there.
Yeah, perfect. On that note, another show is going to come to a close. If you have your own questions, we encourage you to reach out. Go to our website, jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. On there, you can find a contact form and fill it in. You can also learn a little bit more about us on the website if you're interested. If you're a new listener, don't know what's going on here. If you listen to a handful of shows, you'll probably get our shtick, but a lot more information is on the website. You can also email Jim directly the questions if you prefer. jim@jimhelps.com. That'll get, either way, the questions will ultimately be noticed unless they get, I don't know, thrown away in the
thrown away, the deleted, moved to it. There's any number of things that happen to my
if
emails.
You don't hear your question handled within, oh, I don't know, 6 months, send it again.
The only thing we'll throw out there, though, listeners, is we get much more questions, many more questions, than we do time to answer. So if you would like a second or a third EDU Q&A show,
oh my gosh,
email Chris at jimhelps.com and let your voice be heard.
On that note, that's the end. Everyone have a nice week. We'll be back with you next week with another show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Salmier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salmier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.